Used to the weight of that. Good morning. The committee is called to order. The Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection for today, Tuesday, January 25th. This morning, I'll just say that we probably won't use the entire time, but it depends on questions. Again, we're using this time for members. I know some of our members are not insurance agents. Some are. We have several on the committee that have experience in the insurance industry. For those who don't, it's a lot of learning about what the industry is about. It can be, and there's different aspects to it, of course. And today we're going to be spending our time on life insurance and also property and casualty. And now tomorrow we will be spending some time on health insurance. And that's where we would overlap with the health committee in some respects. Some bills that will come to us will go to both committees. If it deals with the practice of healthcare or medicine, things like that, it'll be the health committee. But if it impacts on the insurance and payments, those sorts of issues, it'll come to our committee. So those are the two issues we'll be dealing with this week as far as overviews. And I will say that we have a grand total of two bills so far that have been referred to our committee. And I will tell you that there is an avalanche waiting. It's just kind of on the mountaintop waiting for that to come down, because there are a lot of issues that are percolating out there. And I'm just trying to nudge those along to get bills introduced so we can start digging in on those. But it is a little slower start for us. So this morning, what we're going to do is we're going to start off with Robin Rowan. And she's going to be talking about life insurance, and you can come up to the table, Robin, and please introduce yourself, and I'm just going to turn it over to you, and you're going to educate us all about the life insurance industry. And Bob, you wanted to participate as well. Okay.
Can I have the gavel? Just put it here. If you're going to turn it over, can I just kind of...
I'll take that
as a no.
I worked hard for that.
You did. That's true. Chairman Gerlach, members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. And I want to very much thank the committee for inviting me here today to talk to you about life insurance. Might surprise you, but I don't get a lot of invitations to talk about life insurance, so I'm very excited to be here to do it. I wanted to start by talking, giving you some background on the actuarial science behind the latest mortality tables, but I know Bob and Marcus are afraid that I might lull you to sleep anyway, so I'm going to pass on that. But if you want it one-on-one, I'm happy to talk about it anytime. And it does actually work to put children to sleep, because I've done it with mine. So you have a PowerPoint thing in front of you that I'm just going to use to talk through. Ever since I worked in the corporate world, I just think in bullet points now. This is they burn it into your brain. So just as an aid to walk through. So what I want to start talking about is life insurance companies aren't really just life insurance companies anymore. They really are financial services companies. That can be reflected in the tremendous number of name changes that you might have seen if you've been paying attention. Just some of the latest are, Minnesota Life right here in St. Paul is now Securian Financial. Catholic Aid, which is also in St. Paul, is now Catholic United Financial. And, there's a series of those. But the point is that it's not just about life insurance anymore. And what you have in front of you is a list of the typical portfolio that a life insurance company offers now. Many of these issues come before this committee. Obviously, life insurance bills come here. The focus tends to be on not so much on claims, because that's, relatively simple. Did they fog up the mirror, didn't they? But a lot of you see more underwriting issues. Annuities also come before this committee, as does long-term care insurance, which has been getting some attention lately because it's often viewed as an alternative to reliance on medical assistance. We also, most life insurers write disability insurance, and we also do a lot in the retirement security area. Those issues don't come here very often, but we're very active in that area. Many life insurance companies now also own banks since the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed. Our products are sold primarily through insurance agents and financial advisors, and also a number of bills come before this committee dealing with continuing education requirements to ensure that those agents are well-educated and that it's a streamlined and efficient process and not overly burdensome. And I think I would also add that reliance on these products has increased as you've seen sort of traditional retirement options disappear. So as pensions go away, as medical assistance becomes more strained, people are more and more taking it upon themselves to take care of their own retirement security. I want to talk a little bit about the life insurance industry here in Minnesota. You might not hear much about it, but Minnesota has a really robust life insurance industry that has a tremendous impact on the economy. We have 15 domestic life insurance companies here, which is a big number. I mean, we do rival Connecticut and New York for that, which is, you know, in our world is a badge of honor. We have about 400 plus foreign companies, and by foreign, you remember Commissioner Rothman said it's not foreign, but it means they're not domiciled here in Minnesota. Minnesotans own 3 million individual life insurance policies, which is a lot of coverage, and the average coverage is $130,000 per policy holder. So that's, life insurance is clearly being used to provide security for families here in Minnesota. Life insurance companies paid out over $1 billion in annuity benefits last year. Life insurers are big employers here. We employ over 30,000 Minnesotans. We also support about 33,000 other jobs that are related to the life insurance industry. And last year, in 2009, we paid $1.3 billion out in payroll. So we have a very big presence here. We also, life insurers have a lot of assets. We are handling a lot of money for people. We help grow that. And we invest a lot of that here in Minnesota. Around $50 billion we invest, primarily through municipal bonds, state bonds, and stocks.
Ms. Rowan, could I ask a question?
You may.
When we do the health insurance, we're probably going to see a chart that shows the top three as far as market share companies in Minnesota, and then it drops off dramatically. For all of the others, what's left of the market. What would a graph of the life insurance industry look like in Minnesota? Minnesota companies, as far as what is the distribution of the market share for life insurance?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's much more equitable than that. You can't say, like, for the health insurance at 3%, right, you know, 89% of the marketplace. It's much more equitable than that, and it's much more evenly split. I think even more so than the auto industry, probably. The top writer probably has about 8% of the market.
Okay.
I do want to devote a couple of minutes to fraternal benefit societies. They are a unique kind of insurance company. They are not-for-profit membership organizations that sell life insurance. We also have a very robust fraternal environment here. We have 5 domesticated here, and only Pennsylvania has more fraternals than we do. You're probably familiar with some of them without necessarily knowing that they're any different, like Thrivent Financial for Lutherans or Catholic United, Knights of Columbus, Sons of Norway. And I flag them because they have their own chapter in the code, and they're different, and they're treated different. So oftentimes when we're dealing with life insurance issues, we need to separately address how fraternals are handled. And just a little history here. I find it interesting. I hope maybe you will too. Humor me if not. Most of these fraternals began as social clubs. So, for example, Degree of Honor, which is located in St. Paul, used to be the Ladies Auxiliary of the Ancient Order of United Workers. And what they were, it was a group of women who were married to railroad workers. And when there was a death, the women would pool their money and pay out and help the widow and her children. And so that eventually morphed into selling life insurance. And so that's how the fraternals actually got started. I also want to spend a little bit of time on how we're regulated. A lot of people might not want to talk about insurance, but they all want to regulate us. So we are touched by numerous entities, and I thought it would be helpful for the committee to understand. Plus, this committee in the past has spent some time talking about the possibility and the threat of the federal regulation of insurance, especially on the life side. So I did want to spend a little bit of time on this. We are still primarily regulated at the state level, as you heard from Commissioner Rothman the other day, but not solely regulated at the state level anymore. You know, life insurance is somewhat different from property and casualty in that there aren't a lot of variations based on geography or by state. I mean, mortality is pretty much the same in California as it is in New York, as it is in Kansas. So the product is pretty much uniform nationwide. In addition, as you saw from my first slide, life insurance companies have become much more of financial services companies, and we're competing with other companies for control, for assets and company and customers, other companies that are not regulated by 50 states. So traditionally, when we want to get a product to market nationally, we have to get it approved in 50 states. You know, if we're competing with banks or with Goldman Sachs or other companies for assets, they don't have to do that. So there has been a debate going on for quite some time about whether there should be an option for a federal charter for insurance companies as there is for banks. One of the things, and that has been, as Senator Shide knows, tremendously controversial, and states have significant concerns about that. One of the compromises that was developed was something called the Interstate Insurance Product Regulation Commission. We have a knack for catchy names, if you haven't noticed, or the IIPRC, as it's fondly known. And what this is, basically, it's an interstate compact of which Minnesota, when we passed this, I think in 2006, was the state that pushed the compact into viability. You needed a certain number of states to make it viable. But the purpose of the compact is for life insurance filings, so that we can go to the compact, get our filings approved, and then be able to sell the product in however many states are members of the compact. So it tremendously simplified the going to 50 different states and going through 50 different approval processes. Now there are 38 states that are members of the compact, which has been a tremendous boon. The average approval time for our filings is about 39 days, which is great, because previously you could wait a year and a half for your product to get to market. What's great for the state is that it frees up resources and regulation on the enforcement and compliance side here in Minnesota, plus we still pay filing fees for the state. So the state doesn't lose any money, but it helps us be more efficient and compete nationally. So we've been very pleased with how the compact has turned out. Acronym you also probably hear us use quite a bit is NAIC, which is the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which is basically a trade association for the 50 state insurance commissioners. Its primary purpose is to help insurance regulators protect consumers and financial solvency of the industry. All of our financial laws are based on NAIC models, and that's primarily what they do is they develop models. And it helps keep insurance regulation uniform across the country. And this is not just for the life insurance side, it's for P&C and for health. But the financial area is where the NAIC's strength is.
Ms. Rowan?
Yes.
I understand that. I mean, in some states, the insurance commissioners are even they're elected positions. Some of them are they have a title of insurance commissioner. And now in Minnesota, is it our Department of Commerce commissioner who is that equivalent? Is that would be the person here for
Mr. Our Chairman, members of the committee? That's correct. Okay. So Commissioner Rothman would be our prime representative at.
Okay, Senator Kozalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rowan, it's just a question related to continuing ed and the NAIC. I know they make recommendations. I've got one in particular related to long-term care. I think every 2 years you have to have continuing education. Then there's another one, ethics. Every 2 years you have to have continuing education. From a company standpoint, there's not a lot left for actually training agents on all the other things that are out there. Is there any discussion about making that a little bit longer time frame? Meaning, right now, if every 2 years you have to have long-term care training and ethics training, you know, what about auto insurance and life insurance and disability, all the other things that the agent would like training on? And from a company's perspective, it would seem to me you're not getting them as much training as they would benefit from. Never thought about it before, right?
Yeah. No, I have. Mr. Chairman, Senator Kozalka, yes, and that is something we hear often from the agent trade groups, you know, is that, and as they keep piling on more specific, more in-depth training in certain areas, you are, you know, it makes it harder and harder, and your training could certainly become a full-time job. I don't know if the NAIC is doing anything to make that necessarily more efficient. But I do know there's an overall concern, obviously, from companies as well as regulators and agents themselves that you want them to be as educated as possible in the wide array of products that are offered. As I mentioned earlier, there's been significant debate about regulating insurance companies at the federal level. As it was originally envisioned as sort of an optional federal charter, you know, akin to the banks, that's pretty much off the table at this point. Now we basically are dually regulated and will be, and that stems a lot from the Dodd-Frank bill and the financial crisis. We are now known, and I have to write this down because I never can remember this. We are now known as systematically important non-bank financial companies, according to Section 113 of the Dodd-Frank bill. And basically what that means is that the Federal Reserve can take over supervision of a life insurance or other systematically important non-bank financial company if they think that there is significant risk to the financial system as a whole if this particular company is experiencing troubles. There's still a ton of rulemaking, and so the extent of what this means is still very much up in the air. We are actually very concerned about it. We think the state financial regulatory system is incredibly strong and has been, and I do want to spend a little time talking about that in just a minute. But there's also now a Federal Insurance Office, or FIO. There's no director of that, and it's primarily to study how to make the insurance system more efficient, but there doesn't seem to be a ton of there yet. But the Financial Stability Oversight Council, FSOC, that's the one that's determining to what extent, you know, the feds can come in and oversee the financial stability of an insurance company. The SEC has also tried to get their hands on insurance regulation as well, and that had to do with certain kinds of annuities that were indexed to the stock market. And the big question was, is it insurance or is it an annuity? We wanted to keep it regulated at the state level and not at the SEC. The SEC promulgated rules, but they were sued by the agents in some insurance companies, and it was decided that it has to be at the state level. So we were able to keep that out of the hands of the SEC. I want to touch briefly on solvency because that's been a big topic, certainly with the financial crisis. And I do think, and I think Bob would agree, as would our Department of Commerce, that financial regulation has really been kind of the shining star of the insurance regulatory system. It's uniform across the state. There have barely been any insolvencies. In fact, there's only been one life insurance insolvency resulting from the recession, and that company was in Indiana, and it was rehabilitated, so it never actually went belly up. And I think, you know, with all the talk about, with AIG, and people always call it an insurance company, and I don't think there was enough publicity around this, but it was actually the insurance piece of it was, in fact, solvent. It was in very good shape. And, in fact, AIG went to the New York regulator and said, hey, can we take money out of the insurance company and help with the rest? And the insurance regulator was like, no. I mean, that's for policyholders. According to law, we have to set certain amount of reserves aside for policyholders. You didn't hear about that a lot. You just heard about, you know, AIG, too big to fail, big insurance company. But it was the insurance piece of it that was, you know, very strong and remained solvent. Our solvency is very, very highly regulated at the DOC level. I mentioned our reserves, how much we have to keep in reserves, how much risk we can take on in terms of investment is very highly regulated, what types of investments we can make, and how much of our capital can be invested in certain kinds of instruments is very highly regulated. And I think, you know, I think the results speak for themselves. I think it's been a very, very successful system. We have a state-based safety net for consumers if an insurance company should go belly up to ensure that their interests are protected. And as I mentioned before, only one life insurance company since the recession has run into trouble.
Ms. Rowan?
Yeah.
I have two questions for you. One is, how do the reserve requirements compare to the other aspects of insurance? I know, for example, are there different reserve requirements for life insurance versus property and casualty versus health? What do you know about how that's regulated with the Department of Commerce?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, there are different reserve levels for different kinds of companies, and they're related to how much risk you take on.
Okay. And my other question is, last committee hearing, we had a discussion about, with the Department of Commerce overview, when we got to the banking section, about the watch list, and we had a lengthy discussion about that. Is there an equivalent watch list, per se, for insurance companies, or does that not exist within the departments?
I'm looking at Robert. I don't, Mr. Chairman, members of me, I don't think there's a watch list. You know, we have something called risk-based capital, which is in the statute, so that the insurance department knows, you know, sort of what our ratio of risk to capital is. And we have to give that to them every year. So they very closely monitor where our financial solvency is, but I'm not aware that there's any kind of watch list.
Okay. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, to that point, too, I'm just wondering with the ratings, you know, where insurance companies are rated, you know, on a variety of levels, if that's maybe where they trigger more oversight. You know what I'm talking about?
AM Best? Yeah. Is that?
AM Best or Standard & Poor's or Moody's or wherever, they have their ratings of companies, so if that begins to drop.
Mr. Chairman. This is your first time at the microphone, so maybe you can introduce yourself.
Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Robin and I had talked. It would be helpful maybe to have us both here because some of these questions would come up. They cross all areas. The AM Best rating is really a separate rating system. I think that your question about does that relate to who they flag, insurance companies licensed have to file annual CP8 audits. There's a lot of information that comes in that gives them the tools to really know specifically the financial health of individual companies. I think that's just one tool out there. Mm-hmm. I think it's put out for really kind of a broader basis of the public and buyers to look at a uniform rating system. I think the real heart of the regulation solvency, as Robin said, is in the information that's filed annually. There's uniform blank statements mm-hmm. that it's very detailed on every aspect of a company operations, including the reserving, which does vary by line. So the regulators have the tools in hand to be monitoring annually. You know, the financial health of a company, if there's any action that needs to be taken or, you know, communication with them. So I think that's probably the more important tools, and from my perspective, of watching and monitoring and flagging, you know, potentially troubled companies.
In addition, different levels of, you know, different risk levels will then trigger different actions by the insurance department by statute. So they have the tools to come in and fix.
Okay.
I thought I would spend just a couple minutes on stranger-originated life insurance, because that's something the committee in previous years has spent a tremendous amount of time on. For those of you who may not know, stranger-originated life insurance is the practice of using life insurance as an investment, as a solely investment vehicle as opposed to protection for families. And basically the way it worked is that investors would find someone and induce them to go buy a life insurance policy with the sole purpose of selling it back to the investors. Then those policies were being bundled and securitized in what Business Week called death bonds. And then they were, basically selling them, not all that different from credit default swaps or the commercial mortgages or any of those other back in sort of like the go-go days when exotic investments were far more common. We passed our bill 3 years ago. It was one of the strongest in the country in terms of acting as a deterrent to STOLI. Since then, 30 states have taken action of it. Three states have based their laws on Minnesota, and two additional states are considering a Minnesota-based approach. These new laws and the financial crisis, because capital just wasn't so freely available, have really slowed the growth of STOLI. But folks are very ingenious, and so now they're looking at stranger-originated annuities, and they're using the annuities that have death benefits as targets. And because you don't traditionally medically underwrite if you're going to buy an annuity, they would find people that were very, very ill, induce them to buy an annuity, and then when they die, the investors would get the benefit from the life insurance policy. So we've made a lot of progress on that issue, so I wanted to provide an update. And that's all I had. I don't know if anyone else has any questions.
I think the Senator Scheid, you carried the STOLI bill, mm-hmm. right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And you actually carried all the technical stuff that goes with it, too.
Yes. So we did the viatical settlements was another piece. Now, there's still certainly commercials on TV we see, so we didn't decimate the market as people claimed a couple of years ago when we did viatical settlements. Right. Maybe you could explain for the committee members the difference between the Stolar or the viatical settlements and what that means.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, viatical settlements really stemmed from our, if you legitimately bought a life insurance policy and you are ill and you no longer need it, it really kind of stemmed from when AIDS was a death sentence as opposed to a disease that could be treated. And so people were looking to sell their life insurance policy so they could have cash up front. And that's the viatical settlement part of the industry, which is opposed to inducing people to buy life insurance for solely for investment purposes and without an insurable interest. I mean, basically, when you buy life insurance, you're supposed to have an interest in the beneficiary is supposed to have an interest in the insured staying alive for kind of obvious reasons. I mean, I joke about my husband. Sometimes he's got an interest in me staying alive and maybe not so much other days. But so that's the premise of the insurance. Viaticals is kind of the legitimate side of that business. You have the policy. You no longer need it. But you want to make sure that there are consumer protections for that process. And so that was the bill. It was an NEIC model. Now that everyone knows what that is. It was an NEIC model that Senator Gerlach carried 3 years ago as another piece to the STOLE, which Senator Scheid carried.
Questions for Ms. Rowan on life insurance, which is the life of the committee hearing today, huh? All right. Well, then no members having any questions, we'll move on to the exciting world of property and casualty insurance. And what's that? Yeah, we're going to talk about a couple of things. We're also going to talk about the Farm Mutual. So Marcus is going to have a chance to explain what his industry is about as well, how that fits in. I don't know if you needed to come to the table, if maybe replace Ms. Rowan, if you wanted to do that, since these are very related.
Yes.
Okay. Right. We'll let you off the hook then. Thank you very much for your presentation, Ms. Rowan. And we know that you represent the industry, not a specific company. And if folks have those high-altitude questions about life insurance and the marketplace and what's going on in Minnesota, you're a tremendous resource for us. So thank you. Okay. Mr. Johnson, if you want to lead us into the overview of the property casualty insurance market in Minnesota.
I will. Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you. Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. And I do have a handout, and if you could pick that up, I'm going to kind of walk through the pages. There's a lot of data in there. I won't necessarily read through that, but I'll flag it. I know it's a little heavy, but you'll see. It'll go relatively quickly. And two things, just maybe in terms of experience, Mr. Chairman, I've been coming to the Senate Commerce Committee for 30 years working on property casualty issues, so I do have some history. And if time permits and if there's interest, I could give you some flavor of kind of what's flowed through the years and decades and when there were key issues, key focal points, if there's some interest in that. But in terms of the system and the issues that have been here, I've worked on most of the PC issues, obviously, through those years. And what I do on the second page, I just have for the committee just kind of a brief outline of the points I'm going to hit. And I won't read through that, but we'll just turn to the next page, and I'll just the next two pages then. I actually made a copy, and I'll cite to some of these, Mr. Chairman, that these are the chapters in Minnesota law today that govern. It's actually all insurance, so property casualty and life, health, annuity, the whole picture. And I'll reference some of these chapters in just a very overview comment in terms of some of the areas of regulation, where the state today regulates, a little bit about that regulation. And throughout this, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy if questions are appropriate at any time is fine.
Okay, absolutely.
So those two pages, if you turn to the next page, then in terms of types of insurance, and this is to those whose careers are in insurance, I apologize here ahead of time because this is basics of property casualty insurance, but I thought it'd be good to start with the basics, and then we can dig into any of these if you'd like to in terms of specific questions. On the types of insurance, I just broke down here the major lines under personal lines, so what consumers are buying. Obviously, the auto homeowners and renters are the main ones. And then under commercial lines, what Minnesota businesses buy. And what I've listed, really the four primary coverages that most businesses buy in Minnesota today are the first four. And that most of these are self-explanatory, but the property, liability, commercial vehicle, and work comp. And then I think I've listed there other, not routinely, but if the business needs it, other coverages that you'll see businesses buy, the umbrella, specialized liability, terrorism. And then I put the specific categories under specialized liability. So, again, if you're in a business, if you bought coverages, you're familiar with this. But these are pretty much the list of coverages that businesses are going to be shopping for in the marketplace. And at the end of that page, what I put there is that many times businesses will buy these in standardized business packages. They're called business owner policy, BOPs, acronyms. There's a lot of acronyms in insurance. As businesses get bigger, more specialized, they're not going to be using these standardized packages. You'll see them obviously buying coverages tailored to the specific industry, service, product, and you'll see variations off of that. But those are the core coverages that businesses will be buying. The next chart, and you've heard this, so this is the data that you saw from Commissioner Rothman in his presentation, as Robin mentioned, just a snapshot in terms of the Minnesota-based companies, both property casualty, in this case the 46, but then the number of, and those are companies with home offices, headquarters in the state, and then the rest are doing business in Minnesota. They have to have a license, but that's the full pool of companies. So just a refresher of the committee of the carriers in the marketplace. The next slide, I just thought we'd do a quick snapshot so the committee can see at least some kind of macro perspective on how many dollars, premium dollars, are paid. And so on that chart, if you add the first three, then that would constitute the premiums that consumers are paying in Minnesota for their auto insurance, personal auto policies. So as you can see, that's slightly over $3 billion is paid. And then the categories from there, the commercial coverages and the dollar amounts, the work comp. And I didn't put historical kind of trends, Mr. Chairman. That's available. One of the sources that this is pulled out of, and I should have said it up front, but if I would encourage committee members, if you're interested in a compendium of a lot of facts in all of these areas and really a lot of even historical trending of just what are the numbers, Minnesota really versus all states. There's the Insurance Information Institute puts out an annual fact book, and it's truly that. It's just facts about the industry. So a lot of this is pulled out of that fact book, and there's, again, a multitude of more information in there. But just as an example, in the workers' compensation premium, that's under $800 million. There was a day and an era in the legislature and those around the table that maybe reached back in that day and era. There was a lot of debate up in the legislature about the work comp system and the total premiums paid by employers in an earlier decade was well in excess of $1 billion. So just some historical context that those numbers do change over time, and they actually change based on the state laws. As Robin said, the property casualty industry and these lines vary quite a bit state to state because the state-specific statutes do govern and directly impact what are the dollars that are going to be paid out of those systems. And as you can see, we listed the federal flood. Flood insurance is not a coverage sold by the private market, so there's a federal flood program. Not a lot of it is purchased in Minnesota. I think as you all are aware that there have been legislative sessions and special sessions dealing with floods in Minnesota, and it's a federal program. It's limited use in terms of the consumers buying it. So with that, then, Mr. Chairman, we can move to the next one. It's just
maybe I could interrupt you, Mr. Johnson. Why is it that the private market doesn't offer flood insurance? Is it that the catastrophes are too large to?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think the nature of the risk. So if there's flooding up in the Red River Valley, and there's a zone of geography where everything's likely to get wiped out, and that really takes itself kind of out of the private insurance risk mechanism, both I think in the ability to estimate and price the risk and put a fair premium on it because it's isolated in who has the exposure. And so are you going to charge people in directly the floodplain enough money to pay for the risk, or are you going to spread it over to people who don't have flood risk and they're going to pay for some of that? So I think the nature of the risk, that makes it decidedly different than cars and homes and businesses and work comp. And you go through the list, those lines of coverage don't have that same descriptor as I talked about, the flood risk.
Thank you. Oh, yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Johnson. Just to help me through, as a former builder, realtor, to understand, and mayor, when we, you know, cities don't allow people to build in floodplains anymore, so this whole flood thing, I mean, when floods come, people want to understand, when did that all change? You said you've been around here 30 years, so perhaps you can give us some history of when we changed to not allowing people in floodplains to build and things like that, and when flood insurance really came into existence.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, it's been that way as long as I've been around. So I guess if the history pre that, I don't know that I can give you. We could find out off the top of my head. I don't know the year of enactment, kind of the federal program. But I think that the risk, if you will, and the characteristics have always been that extent. But I do think, Mr. Chairman, Senator, that what the local units and do, it does vary. And I think I don't know that there's been a consistent kind of pattern, even among local units of government, on some of those code issues that you're referencing.
Senator Jungbaugh.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair Mr. Johnson, if you could find that out, that would be really good because as we have floods and they're, you know, natural occurrences and things, we've actually had people around the Capitol, and not from the Red River Valley, but I can think of one gentleman in particular that owns a bar in the floodplain and brags about how every 3 to 5 years he gets a new bar paid for by the taxpayers because of the way the flood insurance works, and we allow people to rebuild that have been there. And so it becomes a concern to our constituents as to, you know, if we know something's going to keep flooding and we don't mitigate that flood area, why do we as a taxpayers are really on the hook in that flood insurance and the rebuilding of that? So I think it's important to understand that long term of how we're going to take care of that risk. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Johnson. Senator, just a couple of more comments because it's not unique to flooding either. There is quite a debate nationwide and out in Washington about hurricanes and coastal risk and who should bear the risk and the cost of that. So I would tell you, and there's been some considerable debate in Washington even about the federal flood program, kind of the scope of it. Again, who should be in, who should not be in, and building in these areas. So it's an ongoing kind of live wire, I would describe it as, and there's been some major bills out in Washington introduced that would change that playing field in terms of who pays and how you deal with that, and whether or not you should be able to build in an area where hurricanes are going to regularly hit, and then because there's a fair amount of risk there, and if properties are being rebuilt, you know, should you permit that? So there's quite a debate surrounding that. We haven't seen it that much play out at the state level. Now, nowhere near to the extent of some of the coastal states in Washington, but I'll follow up and get you some of the history and details of that.
Okay. Another question? Or you?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, thank you. And that does become a big issue is the who pays in the end. And we don't, I think it's our job to restrict, you know, private property use, but it's certainly our job to look over if something happens when you build, whether it's in a hurricane zone or flood zone. We ought not to be on the hook for it. So we have been in the past, and I think that is a big issue that on our level in Minnesota we need to look at in terms of floods.
Okay. Senator Vanderveer.
Mr. Chair, I don't know who would answer this question, but when I was a builder, you couldn't get a permit to build in the flood zone. And I'm just curious, you know, every session or every time there's a flood, we, you know, appropriate money. And I'm wondering, like Senator Jungbauer's friend, why we keep rebuilding in the flood zones, at least if we're going to help people that were in a flood, maybe help relocate them out of the flood zone. But I don't know where this would fall under, but it just seems curious to me that something's inconsistent. I'm not understanding, I guess.
I guess it's more of a statement. Okay. Any other questions?
I don't know if it was. I mean, do you know the answer, okay. Mr. Johnson? Well,
Senator Bonhoff, I think, did you have a question? Are we going to answer? Okay, Senator Brown.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, are there state regulations that govern how agents in Minnesota explain a flood insurance policy, being that it's a national or a federal policy? And the reason I ask is for flood insurance, kind of the flip side to what Senator Jungbauer was describing is if someone it goes through a flood, but the result, if the damage is from the ground swelling because of the flood, they have, there's no coverage for them. They have a flood insurance policy, but it covers nothing if the the damage is due to the ground swelling because of the flood. And I'm just curious, does the state have any regulations over agents who sell flood insurance fully explaining the details of the policy?
Mr. Chairman, I may have to dial a friend back here from the Commerce Department on that one, on the continuing education. My recollection, and I may not be recalling this right, we do have specific statutes that govern the licensure, the continuing education of agents and their conduct. And I guess I don't remember if there's a specific flood requirement in that. No. So I think it's been, as and the legislature has had some special sessions dealing with floods in portions of Minnesota, and I know there have been talks, at least in that context, about whether or not there should be some education disclosure requirements from agents, brokers to consumers about that. I think that the challenge, and I think the frustration, having I'm a native Minnesotan, I have relatives up in the Red River Valley, so there's areas of the state that flood, and they kind of flood regularly, that there's a frustration because many, many people, you can almost buy the coverage when the water's coming down the street. It's not that far away when you can buy it, and most don't. If you look at the data here, it's a very minimal amount of policies that are sold, so there is a mechanism to help people in place, and I have to tell you, I would describe it as not being utilized. So that's a question. I don't really have a solution to that. I think we've talked about that. And I don't know if the agent education agents are dealing with those people, and they're selling them their coverages, their homeowners, and it's through the agents that marketing is going to take place.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, from my recollection, there is a 30 or 60-day waiting period from the time you buy the policy to when it goes into effect. My concern is not that I want to see more regulation in Minnesota, but flood insurance policies are not inexpensive, and when someone spends that kind of money and ends up not having coverage because of a flood, I feel like consumers of those policies in Minnesota are really left hanging, and I'm just wondering if there's something we can do to improve that.
The pounding you hear is probably Senator Limmer putting up more plaques.
So looked pretty full in there the other day when I saw it. I don't know.
All right. I'm sorry. I got you off track, Mr. Johnson.
Back to the next page.
Senator Bonhoff had a question. Yeah. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, I actually heard a couple questions in Senator Vandeveer's comments, so I wondered if you'd be willing to address those. It seemed to me there was a question if we don't allow people to build in floodplains going way back, how come so many people are in the floodplains and then we allow them to rebuild if they were grandfathered in? Is there something that should be done with regard to that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I apologize. Yeah, Senator Vandeveer asked that. I'm not an expert on the kind of local government zoning, building codes. As far as I know, you can build. I mean, the federal government does floodplain maps, and they periodically update them to designate flood zones. So there's quite a bit of data developed to the geography. But I believe that building is taking place in these areas. And so, again, I'm not familiar with the zoning requirements and those variations. So I guess I can't address that part of it, if that part of the question. But I think clearly it's a legitimate question. If there's a pattern of losses and the exposure, and, you know, the Red River runs where the Red River runs, and it goes north, and when it's frozen, it probably is going to flood because it's a river on a flat topography. So you just look at the geography, it's kind of predictable what's going to happen. And I know the communities, there are efforts to try to do a lot in terms of the flood walls and dikes and the systems. But I guess I'm just chatting. I don't have an answer to that, to the specific question that Senator Vandeveer had.
Mr. Marsh, you had something to add to that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, and committee members, my name is Marcus Marsh with the Farm Mutuals. I don't mean to interrupt the presentation by Bob. I was also going to just mention really briefly flood insurance because with my going around meeting with new members, I keep hearing, well, what about flood insurance? And I think it's a frustration for us, too. The government has taken it over, the federal government. I know we had a lot of homes and farms flooded a few years ago down in southeast Minnesota with those torrential rains, and it was kind of a nightmare, PR nightmare, because people thought they had flood insurance, and you tell them, well, no, it's a federal program, and it costs $400+ a year, and a lot of people say, geez, $400, I'm going to take a chance. It's expensive on top of everything else. So this thing has been a frustration, I think, for everybody in the room and certainly for us, because I think a lot of times people think they have the flood insurance, and when the waters rise and they don't, you end up having a serious problem for them. You feel terrible.
Well, I'm sure we'll get a chance to delve into flood insurance and these issues a lot this spring. Mr. Johnson, before you move on to the next section, I have two questions on two of the specialized lines of insurance that seem to be newer in the marketplace, and one of them is the identity theft coverage. Could you tell us any information on what the trend line is on that? I assume because it's entered the marketplace, more and more people are buying it. There's a lot of news on this issue. What do you have any information as far as the premiums collected and the claims paid on that at all, anything on the identity theft? And then I was going to ask you about the terrorism as well. But
this would be sure. Mr. Chairman, no, I don't have it here today, but I'd be happy to follow up with you and find out whatever. It is relatively new. I don't have any data on premium claims or trends, but whatever is there, I will get it and deliver it to you.
Yeah, I was just curious about that one. And then the other one is the terrorism coverage. Obviously, this came about a decade ago, less than a decade ago. I know this appeared on my business owner's policy, and I had the option to decline it, and I figured I had a whole lot greater chances of other things befalling me than terrorism, so I opted to not take that. But what do you have any information on the trend line of that as far as I don't know that any claims have been paid. What's happening with the terrorism coverage piece?
Mr. Chairman, and I'll have to follow up also with you on specific data. The comment I'd make here is that the terrorism risk has changed in America dramatically with what's happened in this country in terms of the 9/11. And the federal government has officially, formally entered into the field, frankly, in my opinion, because of some of the disruption in the private marketplace that took place with terrorism. So today, there is a TRIA, Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, and it is a kind of like flood, but it's more a truly a government-private sector a collaborative effort in terms of the risk. But the federal government has a program, TRIA, to which liability insurers risk is moved to that federal box. So that's a brief summary because, to be honest, the private markets found that, again, that exposure, the private property casualty insurers never contemplated in kind of the pricing commercial buildings just disappearing in terms of the property risk involved there and the multitude of business interruption and property. There's just a lot of exposure there that the private mechanism really isn't equipped to handle that. So it's a collaborative effort now under the federal law, and there's ongoing debates about that federal law. And I think a reauthorization of the federal law is coming up here soon. But I'll get more data for you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee about some of the numbers and kind of the marketplace trends and what's going on. I don't have that here right at hand.
Appreciate it. Okay. You can continue on then.
Thank auto
you,
insurance. Mr. Chairman, the next slide chart is just a snapshot picture of what today do we in Minnesota require consumers to buy when they buy an auto policy. So this is just a summary of the coverages today. The minimum statutory limits, the bodily injury liability, the property damage, the personal injury protection, and then the underinsured and uninsured motorists. There's just very short descriptions of them, the dollar amounts. The next page, I just thought it'd be helpful if the committee wanted to see how do our coverage, the minimum mandates, compare with the rest of the states. So just on one page, you can quickly see what the minimum mandates, and of course the way the marketplace works, each one of you as a consumer can buy higher amounts than many often do. But at the minimum, the policies sold in Minnesota have to have these coverages.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I've got a couple questions now, and then when we compare to other states, I'll have a question for you there, too. But this is required, correct? And so my question is, how many people in Minnesota do you guys project are not covering it?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, auto insurance is a compulsory, so it is against the law to drive a car in the state and not have an auto policy. We have estimates. That's the best we can give you. The estimates that we have today are in the vicinity of 15 to 16% of drivers are on the roads without insurance. That probably translates to, I think we crunched it out to about 500,000 to 600,000 cars. And so it's against the law. There are some penalties for it. But I have to tell you, the economy, not only Minnesota, countrywide, has driven up that number. And there's studies that are out there that directly correlate the unemployment rate with the uninsured driver's rate. So in other words, a 1% increase in the unemployment rate, there's close to a one-to-one correlation with an increase in the uninsured driver. And it's the economics. So I think that's the numbers today in Minnesota.
Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, if I can follow up with that one, because I know 5-6 years ago we were talking about this, and we have the ability to track this, and yet we don't. And so I'm wondering why we don't track it. Is there a way that we can work at that? You know, you're supposed to have it. You go in and get your license. You can, you know, put a dummy number down there, whatever. We don't check anything. And even in good times, the number of people driving without insurance is still pretty high. So as far as the tracking part, could you speak to that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka, just briefly, and we've had some of you may, we've had quite a few debates at the Minnesota legislature about what do we do to increase the compliance rate with compulsory auto. And we used to have it was within the Department of Public Safety, a no-fault verification unit where there was a checking on a random basis of all of these self-certifications that was eliminated in 1 year's budget bill. And so today we don't have a unit or that kind of a formal tracking verification system. I think from the industry's perspective, and I guess the specific answer to your question, Senator Gazelka, is that there are efforts afoot nationwide between the auto insurers and, frankly, the state agencies that administer the laws to try to work to get to a web-based verification system. And we're going to need the cooperation of both the private and the public sector and the systems in place. So there are about a half a dozen states that are running pilot projects between auto insurers and, I guess, their counterpart to Department of Public Safety to help work out the kinks of a web-based verification. I believe that's the future where this will end up. I don't know the timing of that, but I think that's the commitment of the industry, because it'd be best to have a police officer in the car to be able to call up on the computer when they're stopping a car and find out right then whether or not they have the coverage. So the technology, I think, is there, but the interplay between the private and the public sector and all the systems that need to be in place is still a work in progress.
And, Mr. Chair, finally, if I could just say the reason why I think that's important is everybody that is paying for insurance pays more for all the people that are not paying for it. And so I just feel like everybody should be doing their part.
Mr. Chairman, and then just some charts. What the next one is just average auto premiums. Minnesota, what's the U.S. average, and then I'm sorry, this one is just the Minnesota trend. I've got a couple of them in a row. This shows what's been trending in Minnesota, average auto premiums. And so as you can see, auto premiums have been dropping in Minnesota. So if you look at the trend lines, really fewer miles, cars are safer, airbags, seatbelt laws, a number of contributors to that. So that's the Minnesota trend numbers. The next one shows Minnesota compared to, I just picked the surrounding states. We can get the data for you all for all 50 states. How do we compare to our neighbors, and then how does that compare to the national average? So to give you some snapshot of a picture, prices of premiums do vary considerably on a state-to-state basis, and this at least shows you those. Then the next one, just to a little brief commentary, that Minnesota today is one of the 9 compulsory no-fault states. So there's, I know, a lot of confusion about this topic, auto insurance slash no-fault, what is it? And this lists the 9 states that have compulsory no-fault. And the nutshell description is this: no-fault is a requirement, and we impose in Minnesota, that all auto policies have to have it, that each one of us has in our own policy. We call it a first-party medical coverage. Personal injury protection is the actual words in the statute. PIP coverage, it's medical and wage loss. And it's intended to be a place where if you're in a car accident and you need to go to a health care provider, that you get coverage right away from your own policy and it'll pay for it. Subsequently, the liability systems can and may kick into play. The health insurance could come into play. But no fault was intended to provide a mechanism to pay for those injuries. And then the quid pro quo was that then the law was written to take minor lawsuits out of the civil justice system so those wouldn't go to lawyers. And if you look at the Minnesota statute, you'd see that written in the intent clause and what the legislature intended to do. We passed ours in 1974. I just put on this chart, there was a lot of activity around America on passing no-fault laws in the early 70s. 24 states were the maximum number that did enact compulsory no-fault. Today, as I indicated, there's 9. So quite a few states have repealed their no-faults. 3 have an optional or choice, and then we listed some states that we call them add-on no-fault. There's a medical coverage that consumers can buy, but it's not a compulsory system. So that's just a snapshot, Mr. Chairman, and a little bit of history about the Minnesota system. And then I just I put a chart in just to show you the top 10 companies.
I'm sorry, one second. Senator Gazelka, you have a question on?
Sorry to ask all the questions, but I think these are relevant to things, legislation that I think we're looking at right now. But because I see billboards all around the metro down here, you know, certain health care providers, you know, when after you dial 911, dial 411 pain. Yeah. And I know it's all related to this coverage you're talking about now. And I think it's the concept is good. I think people appreciate being able to get the coverage. But if you look at the differences in premium for Minnesota versus our neighboring states, this, I believe, is one of those areas. But I guess I want you to address that. Certainly this was an abuse over the years. I'm assuming it still is, but I think we need to have open dialogue about that.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, we could say a lot about this one. Hopefully will. I think just for today, maybe I'd comment the billboards. You mentioned 2 billboards. A police officer, after you dial 911, dial 1411 pain. That's a Miami-based chiropractor that runs those billboards. The billboards, there's also quite a few around town. It's got a wrestler on it now. It says 1-800-ASK-GARY. That's a Miami-based chiropractor. So there's, you know, it's a free market, so people can come and do business here. And it's clearly for auto accident victims that the solicitation is intended, because then the number, say if you're in a car accident, you have access to dollars, you know, under the no-fault system. I think as we're a no-fault state, if I and I will show the committee the 50 states, and I think you can track New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, a number of high-priced states are in fact no-fault states. And if you don't have no fault, so 41 states have a traditional tort liability. That's what consumers buy in their policies. They don't pay for a first-party medical. 41 states have that. We're one of the 9 that have a first-party medical. And there's a number of issues surrounding the coverage, the access to it, the cost controls or lack thereof. And hopefully we'll have an opportunity to talk in more detail about that.
And Senator Gazelka, obviously, you know, we will. And committee members, the no-fault issue is there's a range of bills that I'm hearing are going to be coming forward. And I have not seen anything introduced yet. But there anything from making changes to the system, figuring out how to root out bad actors, what can we do to do that, all the way to complete abolition of the no-fault system. So if you have opportunities to study up on the no-fault insurance issue, do so, because we will be spending some time later on this session on that issue.
So.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
The next one then is just a definition, a sheet to show you what's covered under the homeowner's policy. I won't read that. It's pretty standard in terms of what consumers buy in the state, and then some charts that show, again, some trending in the Minnesota homeowner's premium. We actually have had a growing losses in Minnesota and growing premiums driven in large part by hailstorms, tornadoes, significant amount of property losses in our state. And the next chart, you can see that a comparison in the upper Midwest and to the national average, we're higher in the ranking, and we've had more trending of increases.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Dames.
Mr. Johnson? Can you tell me, and this goes to both homeowners and auto insurance, do you have some idea what percentage of the companies are using credit-based insurance scoring now for home and auto?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dames, I think a majority, overwhelming majority, are using credit-based system. And we have a state law that regulates the kind of the parameters mm-hmm. of its use, so a majority.
Thank you.
Just so members know, a few years back, there was quite a debate over whether credit scores could be used in the decision about assessing risk of a policyholder and what the premiums would be, and whether there was a correlation between claims and someone's credit rating, and what role that could play. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the final compromise bill was that it could be a factor but could not be the sole factor. So it plays a role, but not the the sole role. Is that correct, Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, you have described it accurately.
Okay. All right. Okay. Maybe we could go. And also, too, I want to make sure that we do have time for Marcus Marsh to talk a little bit about how Farm Mutual, so I'm going to run out of time.
I'm going to accelerate, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank
so
you.
quite a bit. If you turn to page 23, there's some charts in there kind of self-explanatory. If you're interested, you'll see kind
Mr.
of the
Chairman.
Distribution.
Oh, so yes, Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That just sparked a question with regard to the credit score issue. So as homeowners, for example, credit history change with regard to, you know, their unemployment or employment, is there a mechanism for them to get reevaluated? And do homeowners, it seems to me, they don't really understand that's part of what goes into their premium. So what kind of education and outreach is there done so that people can reapply to get reevaluated?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonner, there is a mechanism. It's in the state law that specifically gives consumers the right to get the rescoring. So I can get you the citation, but it's actually covered in that statute that the chairman referenced. And we can also get you some examples. I've seen a number of companies have literature, brochures, booklets that their agents and producers use with consumers to explain, so what is this credit-based scoring and what does it mean to me? So I'd be happy to get maybe some copies of that for you. You can see that.
That will be, I mean, if you do get questions from constituents a lot of times, that would be very helpful to know that process. So great, great question. So did somebody else have a question? Senator Sparks, do you have a question? No? Okay. All right. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, if you go to page 23, I just wanted to, I'll flag a couple of these and I'll stop because I think I'm not going to repeat some of the, Robin Rowan covered a number of the kind of the base chapters. On page 23, I just thought it'd be helpful for the committee to see that if you're a consumer or a business and you can't get a policy in the marketplace on your own, then our state law has created mechanisms to which the consumer or business can go to buy a policy. And so these are, at least in the property casualty, there's an auto plan, a fair plan, a JUA, and a work comp assigned risk plan to which the individual or business can go and buy a policy. So the state has created mechanisms to do that, and they're in that listing of chapters that I started out with. And really, Mr. Chairman, I think beyond that, maybe the only other one I'd comment is on page 25. And just to have the committee know that I think there's a couple of statutes that are often, you know, the subject of debate, and a number of bills are introduced. The claims practices of insurers, property casualty insurers, but it really covers all. On page 25, we have a specific and very detailed statute that covers the handling, the processing, the response time, the paperwork, for companies and their consumers that are filing claims. So that's in that 72A201. And then the next one, there's some a whole series of pretty detailed statutes governing specific areas in terms of trade or business practices that go to the issue of regulating unfair or deceptive practices on the part of companies in the marketplace. And all states have this, and I just listed it here just briefly for the committee. And then the last one, and I'll end on that, is the page 26, that we do have a specific state statute, the Fair Information Practices Act, that we've had on the books for a long time. And this is the statute that governs in Minnesota insurance companies collection, holding, and redistribution of personal information of their customers. So it's very specific statute, standards, benchmarks, where it can go, you know, how it's kept. So we've had it on the books for a long time, and it's been an effective statute for the protection of personal information of Minnesota consumers, buying policy. So I'll stop with that, Mr. Chairman. I think that's all the key stuff, and I'd be happy to follow up with any committee members on other charts here that I didn't cover.
Are there other questions from committee members? Okay, well, Mr. Johnson, thank you very much. This has sparked a lot of questions. There's a lot of different areas with property and casualty that we're going to be having bills in the committee that are going to be dealing with. So this is a tremendous resource for us to look up those things. So appreciate that. And then the other question, or the next item, is for Mr. Marsh. And you can explain what in the world Farm Mutual is and how does that fit into the world of property casualty insurance for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's always a pleasure to follow Bob. I'm another person that's been hanging around here for about 30 years. Met Bob in 1980 when I was actually running for the legislature. And when I left, I never thought I'd come back. And I was working for the mayor of St. Cloud, came back and worked and lobbied on economic development issues. And 15 years ago, I went with the Farm Mutuals. And they've been really a fun group to work with. And Bob always does a great job, so I'm not going to get into really a whole lot of new territory other than giving you some interesting, maybe not interesting, but some nuances and some a little history of a different aspect of the property insurance area that you may not be familiar with, especially if you grew up in the metro area. And some of our uniquenesses. If a page could pass out this information to the committee members, I would appreciate it. Just so you know, the Insurance Federation is a member of ours, and we are a member of the Insurance Federation, just like the different agent groups and so on, I think, belong to both groups. As far as homeowners insurance, we follow the same law. We do have a separate 67A section and statute for some of the unique history of our mutuals and, in particular, our farm policy. just so you know, a mutual insurance company was first started by Benjamin Franklin in Philadelphia in the late 1700s, and that company is actually in business still today. For our companies, when you look at the little insert inside the folder, we have, I believe the current number is 94 farm mutuals across the state of Minnesota. Only two are less than 100 years old. Our oldest company turns 150 this year. And our association, which is always a nice long name for everybody to try to type in when I've been going around trying to get appointments with your staff, the Minnesota Association of Farm Mutual Insurance Companies. I mean, that's a handle to try to put on your schedule. But we were formed in 1895, our association. We're in St. Joseph, just west of St. Cloud. We insure homes and farms. Some of our companies, if you look at that insert, have quite the interesting names. And again, if you're from the metro area, you probably kind of scratch your head at some of the company names. But the history there is they were named, in most cases, in the township in which they were incorporated. And I'm sure most of you know, but again, the chairman asked to just give you some basic items here today. Mutuals are different than a stock company. You can buy stock in an insurance company if it's a stock company and hope they make some money and pay you some dividends. You can be insured by a stock company. But if you're insured by a mutual, you are an owner of the policy. It's basically, some people like to equate it with a co-op. Quite frankly, if you're insured by one of our mutuals, you're eligible to run for the board of directors of that mutual. You're invited each year to the annual meeting and hear up close and personal, because maybe it's not that far away from you where that annual meeting is held. Because when I started with our association, if you can imagine this, we had a licensed limited service area, and the maximum service area was 150 townships. Now, that's a pretty small area. If you don't know, a township is 6 by 6 square miles. So if our companies were limited to 150 townships, that's a pretty small service area. We changed that in 1999 to 300 townships, because if companies had merged with another mutual, you could go up to 300 townships. So that's where that came from. Actually, in 2009, we passed what we termed the Farm Mutual Modernization Act in the legislature here. And I do have to say, because sometimes government gets kind of a kick once in a while, but we were very appreciative of the good cooperation and working with the Department of Commerce, so that everybody gave a little and took a little, and that's the way it should work. And so we passed our modernization bill. And what that did is make some changes. If our company was secure enough financially, under that legislation, we could go up to 20 counties. We changed the township concept to county, so that the Department of Commerce can regulate by county instead of being confused, and we all get confused with multiple townships. So we're now really county mutuals. And we can go up to 20 counties. Not very many companies did. I think the average company is probably in that 10 to 12 county range. We do have a few in the 20s and some in the teens. But we also have one company that elected to stay in just one county, up in St. Louis County. They didn't want to go beyond St. Louis County. So that was their prerogative. Another interesting fact is that our mutuals, under the statute, could not sell homeowners or farm insurance in communities of the first or second class. So that meant second class are cities from 20 to 100,000. So we could not sell in a city the size of 20,000 unless we were grandfathered in, meaning that we sold there before, because of the age of the companies, before that community became 20,000. And that was kind of an interesting dilemma, because we would have, for example, in St. Cloud area where I live, we would have one company that could sell in all of St. Cloud, one company could sell in the annexed areas, and the next company couldn't sell homeowners insurance in St. Cloud at all. And so in the legislation we passed, that was changed to 150,000. Part of the reason being we had two or three companies selling homeowners, for example, in Rochester. And the thought was Rochester, under the census data, could go over 100,000, and then suddenly we could no longer keep those policies. So currently our mutuals can sell in communities up to 150,000. And we're obviously, I think, going to see fairly aggressive with some of our companies in the metro area, or at least in the fringe of the metro areas. So you're going to be probably, hopefully, seeing a lot more of our member companies in some of the suburbs. One area I just mentioned, because it is kind of funny, for years, going back to the inception of our farm mutuals, you didn't really pay a premium. You paid an assessment. And the way the assessment worked is that at the end of the year, was figured out how much it cost to pay claims, pay for the help, pay taxes, whatever, and then you would get a bill in December based on how much insurance in force that was your cost to the company. So it was considered an assessment. And years ago, for farmers, it was considered that was a good time of the year to do that because most farmers get an operating loan in the spring, and they have a lot of money in the fall. So when that assessment would come in December, they had plenty of money to pay the assessment to keep the mutual afloat for another year. Obviously, that has all went by the wayside, and rightfully so, but we had kept the assessment in the statute for a number of years, and that was kind of a marketing tool a few folks would like to use against us, I guess. Our companies buy a substantial amount of reinsurance because of their size. And, for example, Ram Mutual and ESCO.
Yes. Mr. Marsh, maybe you could explain to us what reinsurance is, since you used the term, and those people
okay.
who are not real familiar with the industry.
Good point. Thank you. Reinsurance is we go to another insurance company and buy coverage, additional coverage. And there are varying contracts available that the reinsurer work with each of our mutuals. So Ram Mutual and Grinnell Mutual out of Grinnell, Iowa, are two major reinsurers.
So it's much like a secondary market.
It's a secondary
for insurance,
coverage.
Like a secondary mortgage market.
Exactly.
This is it allows more capital in the system for also more shared risk.
Yes. We have to share the risk because of our limited size. So we buy a substantial amount of reinsurance. Also, our companies are too small to take on the liability risk. So we also have a packaging partner that takes the liability. So in actuality, you can have one of our mutuals that could have two other companies named in the policy besides XYZ Mutual. It could be the reinsurer would be listed as well as the liability company. So we package a lot. So some of Bob's members that are members of ours, we have a great relationship, and they like us because the agents representing our mutuals come with the business and then package that with the liability in the reinsurance. I want to point out, because sometimes people wonder about competition, and we hear, you know, the government can do things good. We've heard about flood insurance and the confusion and the problems there. All of our mutuals are competitors against each other. And those that we buy reinsurance from or package liability are also direct writers. So they're our partner plus our competitor. And all of our companies compete against Bob's companies, and all their companies compete against our companies. And the free enterprise system works amazingly well, because I don't think that you can put together especially homeowners insurance in the price range and the kinds of service that agents and our companies give any other way except for the free enterprise system that works, again, very, very well. I wanted to follow up on one point I had in my notes, because I was going to talk about flood insurance too, but you covered that well. But just to maybe point out the additional confusion that's out there with it, I was flicking around. I drive my wife crazy if she ever lets me have the control. A lot of times we have two TVs. Don't tell her I said that. But anyway, I'm flicking around. I think it was last Thursday night on the 10 o'clock news. And Channel 9, not to pick on them or support them, just the fact that the gentleman was talking about possible floods this fall. And the reporter never said, he said accurately, that there was not flood coverage in your homeowner's policy, but you should talk to your agent. I mean, the things he said was fine, and there was flood insurance available, but he never actually said the word that the flood insurance is a government program. And again, it's my recollection from what our agents and managers have said, it's in the neighborhood of $400 plus. And I think there's enough confusion out there, and I think the report kind of left it like, maybe that agent of mine didn't really cover everything with me. And again, this is a mess, and it's a confusion. And again, we went through a lot of trauma with it, with a lot of coverage of folks down in southeast Minnesota a few years ago. I'm going to just make a couple other quick comments.
We're running short on time. So.
Okay.
I've got a few announcements as well.
Alrighty. Just the fact that our forte of our companies initially and still is the farm policy. We insure a great industry of agriculture in Minnesota. We insure the majority of farms across Minnesota. We have a unique policy, I think, compared to anybody else, because 100-plus years, you probably have got it right to be in business all those years insuring folks in agriculture. So we insure the majority of farms in Minnesota. Just to give you one example that I think is kind of humorous, that we have thought about everything that needs to be in there, and we have a policy committee that's always updating and reassessing both our homeowners, but in particular our farm policy. A few years ago, there was a Wolf Commission, and some of the longer-term legislators, you probably remember that. And the governor appointed this Wolf Commission, and the humor there was that it was way too big. It was like 25 members, and you had both extremes, from shooting all the wolves to we need 10,000 more. But they got into degradation of livestock and how it was impacting agriculture, and they talked to some legislators over here, the commission, and said, we got to have a law that says somehow the farmers will be protected from loss of animals. Well, it turns out our policy, part of your basic coverage, has that in there. And you can just add more, but it has basic coverage. And once the legislators realized that anybody at least was insured with one of our companies, and again, the majority of the farms insured with our companies already had coverage. And so we, you know, I could bring reams and files of documents and brochures of all the different kinds of coverage and bore you to tears. But in any case, the bottom line is our company's been around 100 years. Insure greater Minnesota. We're expanding markets. I think things have been going well for us. We continue to want to work with the legislature. And so just appreciate an opportunity just to highlight a few differences or uniquenesses within our mutual insurance companies, and look forward to continuing to work with the committee. Thank you.
Mr. Marsh. Does anybody have any questions on property casualty for either Mr. Johnson or Mr. Marsh? Yes, and arrest.
Mr. Chairman, I have just a brief comment. When I was when I first became a CPA and worked in a local tax department of a local accounting firm, one of my friends handed me an essay by a British humorist that was entitled "Why Accountancy Is Not Boring," and it was hilarious. I shared it with my colleagues at the firm. They didn't get it.
All right. Members, I have a couple of quick announcements. I wanted to make sure that you all were aware in your packets is a copy of the Department of Commerce, the Internal Control and Compliance Audit from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. If you remember, when the Department of Commerce gave their presentation, Senator Rest had an excellent question to follow up on what was being done on these. And there's a number of findings that do have to be addressed, and we do want to hold the feet to the fire and get those taken care of. There's a new administration that will be able to handle these. So it's in your packet, and I would suggest that everybody take a look at that. The other housekeeping businesses, I guess I didn't mention last time, the seating arrangement. If anybody has a major problem with who they're sitting next to, usually Senator Vanderbilt has some problems on his end, but I think we're okay. Nobody's complained yet this year. So I think we're okay and functional. Tomorrow we will see the other side of the coin on this insurance side, and that will be the health insurance. This was kind of some of the easy, straightforward stuff. Health insurance, the marketplace is radically different, as you are all well aware, and we're gonna take a look at what's going on there. So with that, members, this committee is adjourned. 2 minutes early.